Welcome to the AI and VI Mix podcast. Today I'm interviewing my psychotherapist, Dr. Nicola Bird. I'm not going to be calling her Dr. Bird. I'm going to be calling her Nicola for this, because I always call her Nicola. So Nicola does a specific kind of therapy, which is called self-imaging therapy. I'm not even going to bother trying to explain it. Can you kind of just jump right into what it is and how you developed it?
Sure. Hi, John, and thanks for having me. Well, self-imaging therapy is something that I started developing about 17, 18 years ago, and it's an image-based approach to well-being and personal transformation. And what it does is it takes you to the root of a problem, and so that you can observe it, look at it, and change it at the root level, so that you can dramatically transform your life and sustain those changes, which is most important of all.
Mm-hmm. And then, and I know it works. I mean, it's...
Thank you.
I've been to different therapists, but your stuff's just so much, I don't know, I just think it's so much better than everybody else. And it cuts to the root of things fast. Is the speed is the one thing I really notice with your stuff, is how quickly you get to something. And go ahead.
Sorry, thank you. Yeah, I'm sorry I'm interrupting. Yeah, I guess I'm answering to that. Well, because I do understand when you say that you've been to other things and you were frustrated and you didn't get the results that you wanted, because I was in the same position. And I wanted myself a mental overhaul. So I had, from childhood, I had an inner gift and a capacity to understand symbols. So I was a prolific dreamer. I had lots and lots of dreams. And then when I was a teenager, I just had an innate understanding of how to translate what was within us. And so I just developed that skill and talent on my own. And then when I found myself at a challenge in my life and at a roadblock, a significant one, and everything was just falling apart, I had myself gone through all kinds of different approaches trying to create change, and the same old patterns were still running the show. And I wanted them to change. So I went back to my initial talents and started really homing in on developing them, because I understood that I need to get deeper. I instead of just looking at things from the outside, I wanted to go within, much further within, to the root of the problem and start making a reconstruction that would really change me from inside out.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't just make, you actually studied this, right?
In terms of studying what I developed, I did it as my doctoral thesis, and so it was part of my graduate studies. But in terms of originally developing it, I did develop it from my own understanding, and then I started working with people. And then I went on to further develop my studies.
Mm-hmm.
So, but it
and
is
then,
what my dissertation and focus was on, was about when I was doing my studies, yes.
Right. And then you and I actually talked about neuroplasticity,
yes,
like a couple of weeks ago.
Yes.
Can you explain more about, like I know, can you explain more about how that's, isn't that, that's kind of the root of the point of this, right?
Absolutely. Because
it works, right?
Right. Because what happens is, why metaphor, symbols, images, which is, you know, it can sound quite threatening, like, what does that mean? And that's, like, out there. But it's not, because most people don't realize, so they think in symbols and metaphors. That's how we think. That's how the brain processes information. So you're just thinking it's a word, but it actually is a symbol of something. You only know a word by its symbol. You know that something means a chair because you have experienced a chair, and then when you're learning language, for instance, you put chair, you see the chair, you have a word. And then if it's a concept of feeling, if you put a word to a feeling, it's because you actually have that feeling and you understand what that means and you can identify. You have a feeling, that's sad, that's happy. But those are all symbolic experiences. So your brain is thinking in symbols all the time. And the interesting thing about the brain is that it doesn't distinguish between what is real and what is imagined. That's why it's powerful. So hence, if you imagine eating a fabulous meal, you will salivate in the same way as you would if you were actually eating it. Mm-hmm. So the power of your imagination is just immeasurable because of that, your brain's inability to differentiate between what is real and what is imagined. So unfortunately, we don't harness that power. And the work is about going into that part of our ability to tap into that innate gift within us and to resource our emotions, which, or our thoughts, which are, they're not tangible to us, but a symbol or a metaphor gives them something concrete so that you can actually connect with something. So let's say if you have a fear or an anxiety, a metaphor or a symbol gives you access to that, and then the mind doesn't differentiate. So then that's how it will then lay new tracks. The other thing is that in how the plastic brain works is that once certain areas get developed, then they become dominant. So if you're, for instance, if you have a lot of anxiety, the brain, those parts are overdeveloped, so to speak, and then the parts that are calm are underdeveloped. So by doing the work where you're creating metaphor to represent new emotional states, like, say, calm, as you change anxiety, then you're developing these other parts of the brain, which will then so strengthen those areas, which will then balance out the problem, and that's how it creates change.
And we're talking about long-term change, too.
Long-term change, because it's not a superficial thing. That's why we're creating new tracks in the brain. Mm-hmm. So in plasticity, the brain gets conditioned a certain way, and again, these are what's wired, and it gets associations, and these wire together. Part of the change is unwiring those associations and rewiring new ones, which is what work with in the imagination, because like I said, the brain doesn't differentiate between what is real and what is imagined, so the new wiring will be computed in the brain as something real. Mm-hmm. And hence it will be, and I can give you some studies if you want.
Somebody might ask, but in general it's plasticity. We know plasticity happens, and we know that what you're talking about is real and will. I mean, now, maybe 100 years ago, people might not have thought about it, but it's becoming quite apparent that this is how things actually work. Now it's kind of like working out, right? Like you have to do repetition at this to make it work.
Absolutely, because it's I consider it developing emotional muscles. So if certain parts, emotional muscles, aren't developed, so to speak, then yes, or, you know, mental emotional muscles aren't developed, you do have to develop them. And how do you get into again what is seems so intangible? Like our thoughts seem intangible to us, our emotions seem intangible. How do we connect to them and make them real for us to change? That's what a metaphor does, a symbol, an image, that's the imagination. It creates something to represent what we can't otherwise reach and change them. And the thing about plasticity that it has the double-edged sword, once something again gets conditioned, it takes over. So a lot of times we don't feel that we can change something, but it's then running the show. If you have a way of thinking or a way of feel, like anxiety or just fear or negative thought, like I'm not good enough, overuse them, or they've been not to necessarily any fault of yours, but it could be conditioning, environment, where that becomes just part of how you've learned to be, then it does feel like it's more powerful than you. And you can't control it. And the feeling is just happening to you. And it's a kind of, again, an intangible feeling. So by metaphor and symbolism, that intangible feeling becomes something you can connect with and touch, and then transform and then establish new parts of the brain. So wire up new parts of the brain and develop other parts, which then that's where repetition comes about. Repetition gets you into a certain zone or lays tracks in the brain. New repetition will create change as well.
Mm-hmm. And that's the point. People don't even think about the fact that they've spent years repeating that pattern that they never chose. It just sort of happened, right?
Absolutely, because, I mean, a lot of the patterns that we have, just in classical thinking anyway, does go back to our childhood. And we learn ways to cope with the world. And if some of those ways aren't healthy, if we learn to avoid a problem, if we learn to be fearful of something, if we learn to think that we don't measure up, if we don't, things like that, and those are repeated enough and we start to process the world that way or deal with challenges that way, then we need a new script. The question is, how do we create that script? And that's where my work comes in. And it's not just about, in your mind, you just tell yourself something new, because that won't be real to you. You can't just go and say, oh, I'm okay when you feel like crap. You have to get in there and deal with the root problem and find new emotional relationships. So meaning, if you don't connect emotionally to a thought or a new way, like, then you can't develop it. For instance, most people, if a person is always anxious, they don't know what calm is. So the question they will ask is, well, how do I feel calm? I don't know how to feel that way because of dominance in a certain area. Most people, when they're in the habit of functioning a certain way, the first question they're going to ask is, well, how? How do I feel calm? How do I feel confident? How do I feel these things? How do I not think of myself that way? Even when I try and tell myself something else, I still go back to that part. That's where the work gets in there and deconstructs some of those old, unhealthy patterns that are ingrained and starts to develop new areas of the mind and body so that, and as those get developed, then those will balance out those other dominant places.
Yeah, it's not, this isn't just positive self-speak affirmation stuff. This is, like, I can attest to it. You go, it's work. It's actual,
yes.
It's actual work. Like, I'm exhausted after, like, I have to go really decompress after a session with you. But it's good, right? Like, it's revealing. It's, I think your stuff's as intense as the most intense workout. It's just, it gets there and you just go, and then you repeat it, right? And then you just have to...
You repeat it, yes.
Yeah, and then you do your exercises, basically, afterwards. But, man, the first... And now the first time is... I found the first time with you... I don't know if the word's shocking or, like, startling. I don't know what it is. But
right.
when you get there the first time and you sort of go through the pattern, it's quite revealing that that's, like... It was a surprise to me, let me say it that way. And I was like, oh, geez, I didn't realize this is actually where the root of the work has to start.
Yes.
And that's pretty consistent, isn't it? Like, I find a lot of other people, like, I've talked to other people who I've sent to you, and they're like, whoa, I didn't realize that's actually, and it's surprising to me that it can be that hidden to us, even though it's, afterwards it seems so obvious. On the way in, it just didn't think that's what it would end up being.
You're absolutely accurate when you say that. It's true. Like, after, you will think, oh my, yeah, you start to see the relationships. It's because when something becomes so ingrained, you stop observing it. When we start out in life, we develop ways to cope and manage life because life is very complicated. And then we develop systems in place because we can't be constantly having to engage different ways to cope with life. We start to develop ways, and those we learn early in life. So if something is difficult to handle, we must have skills in place or coping styles in place to manage. And those just become, after a while, automatic. And if they're unhealthy, then you're not aware of the way that you are self-defeating and or self-sustaining a problem, because you're not really aware of the relationships for why you have developed this pattern or this coping style. It just becomes ingrained. So until you can step back and observe that, which is what the work does, it's not just a mental workout where you're seeing it, you're actually emotionally connected to the problem, and which is a very important part, that you the connection between the emotions and the thoughts and the experience. And yes, so then you're digging, you're going to be able to, you're observing yourself. Whereas you can think of it this way. You know, you can look at a person who you might know, and you'll be able to say, oh, that person's insecure. They might even be able to be aware that they feel insecure, but they might not understand the degrees and how they're managing life from the insecurity or the way that they're viewing the world, although you might hear them talking about it because you're observing their behavior. In the work, you actually step back and observe yourself for the first time and really look at yourself as if you're looking at another person, which is very powerful, and then that gives you a self-observation of your emotional mental states and basically taking your general life and compressing it into like the microcosm to the macrocosm, and you take a bird's eye view of yourself, it can be quite startling, yes, but at the same time, of course, so rejuvenating, because remember, each session is reconstructing, so you always get to that healthy place in each session. It goes full circle to the change and the transformation. But yeah, it is a workout. Even me talking about it, it sounds like a workout.
Yeah, and no matter how clumsy it is, you don't let people stop until they get to the, until they do some fixing at the end of the session or do
some
healing. Yeah, and so it really is a mind. It's like I like how you've been repeatedly pointing out that it is mind, emotion, and then eventually physiology. Like all three things have to get in sync.
And I mean, the whole work is done through the body. I mean, where are your emotions lodged? In the body. So, and that's your, you know from, again, working out that the body has muscle memory, right? Mm-hmm. So, and there is no division between mind and body. So, because if you have a fear, you're going to feel your gut. You know, you're going to feel nausea, you know, a little anxious in your gut. You're going to feel a little tense. Where are these things happening? They're all in your body. They're all stored emotions in your body. Mm-hmm. So there is no difference. So, I mean, all the research shows us that. So, and so if whatever emotion is lodged in the body, we start to dislodge that bodily relationship to that emotion. So we'll carry fear in our gut, hurt in our heart. I'm sure anyone can relate that they understand the metaphor of feeling a heavy heart.
Mm. Yeah, you physically
punched in the gut. Yes, like something happened.
Yeah, anxiety and all that stuff.
You feel it, yes.
Yeah, there's a visceral feeling. You can actually locate, and you can locate the feeling. Yep.
You can locate that feeling. You know that feeling. If you don't step back and self-reflect on that, you're not going to be realizing it's all happening in your body. But of course, you know, where's your tension? It's there in your shoulders, you know. You're carrying the weight of the world in your shoulders. We have these metaphors all the time. Those are emotions lodged in the body. Mm-hmm. How do we dig in there and change that? And that's what the work is about.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so specifically, and now it's specific. Okay, so I think it doesn't really matter. Am I not really getting anywhere with this sentence?
No, you're doing great. Don't worry.
On the topic, thank you, Nicola. On the topic of emotional eating, because we help coach people on getting in shape. It doesn't matter. At least I'm going to throw my two cents in, but you can. And then I want some of your sort of experience with dealing with clients.
Sure.
That eating is an issue. If the root cause is stress, or it doesn't even matter to me if it could be anxiety, it could be some sort of emotional stress, it could be just a sort of a mental fatigue from work or whatever it is, just overworked. Mm-hmm. A lot of roads can lead to food as the therapy, can't they?
Oh, it's so easy for food to be therapy because we have to eat. We have to eat. And from the time, I mean, the first thing we're doing when we're born, eating. It's survival. So food is really a tricky one because of its whole relationship to survival and care and nourishment and goodness and reward.
Celebration.
And reward. And exactly, it's a rewarding thing. It feeds us. It nourishes us. The problem is when these kind of connections, associations get all, you know, interconnected, where unhealthy associations get intertwined with healthy associations. That's really the problem. And so, but of course, food is one of the easiest, I think, things to fall into, or addictions to fall into, or self-soothing attempts.
Sure, and because it's not socially taboo. Everyone does it.
We have to do it to survive.
Right. It's a lot different than relying on booze or some kind of drug, because even then you kind of have external people telling you, you know, you probably shouldn't drink yourself to sleep every night, but not too many people tell you it's a bad thing to eat yourself to sleep every night.
And even if they do, you still have to eat. Like if you go to...
you can't go cold turkey off food
like you can
on a drug.
That's why it's really tough. Exactly. If you go to AA, they say no booze.
Yeah, what are you going to go to?
You can go, you know, you dry out of, exactly, you dry out of alcohol, you dry out of drugs.
Any drug, yeah.
Exactly. You can't dry out of food. You need to eat. Mm-hmm. So it's not like you can't, and it's everywhere. Yeah. Not that, you know, substances aren't everywhere too, but you can't just go cold turkey and not have it. You do have to wake up in the morning and face this every moment of the day. You're going to feel hungry.
For the rest of your life.
Yes, there is no way of getting away from food. There's just no way. So it has that double whammy. It's again, it's a social thing for us. It's also a connection to other people. We go out and eat dinner with people. We do so. There's a lot of associations with food that can make it a really hard emotional battle. But the double whammy with food as well is that. When we are stressed and experiencing pressure, that then results in the stress hormones being activated, that diminishes our metabolic rate, and so we can actually even put on more weight based on. So it doubles up. If you're eating more because of stress, and the stress is also diminishing your metabolic rate, then, yeah, it can be, you're having double impact in terms of your survival.
It just keeps getting worse and worse.
It just keeps getting worse and worse and worse. The more you try to soothe and salve, you know, the wound, put a salve on the problem, the body's shutting down more to cope, and it becomes a vicious cycle.
Mm-hmm. So then have you had people come in specifically for, well, what they thought was emotional eating, but got to the root of it and found out it was, well, maybe not, I mean, whatever it was. Have you had people come in who eating's their problem?
Absolutely. Because, again, that's certainly not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if someone is struggling with eating, they don't have to feel alone at all, which can really be a part of our struggle, feeling isolated and alone and feeling you're the only one struggling with some of these things. Well, you know, the thing with emotional eating is you can really focus when you're dealing with weight issues or just any issue at all on the problem surrounding you. So you can really focus on the food, trying to eat all the right foods, exercise, do those things. But if you're not getting to some of the – and if those things are working and you're moving through, then emotional eating probably isn't – occurring, but if, although we all emotion eat at little points, but if it's not becoming a problem or
it's
creating
not the dominant,
issues, yeah, it's not
the
a dominant,
dominant
yeah, it's not getting in the way, basically. You're not getting stuck in it, then it's okay. But if it is a part of your battle, then it really isn't, it's no longer about the food. The food is your defense. The food is your attempt to protect whatever it is that's the problem. Whatever it is that's hurting you or whatever fear you're experiencing or whatever anxiety, then the food is your self-soothing mechanism. And so really you have to start looking not so much at what you're eating, although you do have to take care, but how you now find healthy ways to address the emotions. And self-care is part of that, nurturing yourself, self-soothing, because really you're trying to soothe yourself. What is the problem that you're trying to soothe? You need to get to what that problem is. If you're struggling with food, what ends up happening is you will be associating this food as something to take care of you. If you remove this food, what do you have? You will keep attaching to that food, because how are you going to take care of these emotions if that's been the only thing that you've been using to help you take care of yourself?
So you end up feeling pretty unsupported on alone. They're alone, just there's nothing.
Yes.
I mean, you can't take the last thing left that's soothing you and get rid of it. That must be terrifying.
You will attach to it as your survival. Exactly. It makes you feel good. If you take this away, what are you going to have?
Mm. And so if you're not working on basically the other thing to, well, I mean, the only other thing is you insert another drug of choice. So if it's not food, maybe it becomes booze. But either way, it's still not going to help until you get to the root of what the wound is you're trying to fix with food.
Yes. And the thing is with habits is that they do take on a life of their own, even independent from the root. So you have a double whammy again, which is what you've heard me refer to.
We're up to about six whammies now.
Yes, but I mean in terms of, but only in terms of food and your relationship to your emotions. Hmm. It's because if you're in that cycle of self-soothing and you're looking for something and you remove it, and that feeling of being so lost without that thing, it can be so hard. So that's what makes you keep returning to it. But if you get to the root, which is very important, you're getting to the root, you now have to completely create another system to manage. You have to find another coping style. And in my work, of course, as you know, that we do all of the above. You're not just getting to the root. Because even if you say, okay, I understand that my insecurity drives me to eat, and I'm trying to band-aid that insecurity or, you know, rescue or feel better because of that insecurity. But if you don't, you have to then find a healthy way to cope with that insecurity, even if you identify what the root of the problem is.
That's my biggest problem with standard psychotherapy is, mm-hmm. yeah, I don't care if you can identify it. You still got to give me something else to do because, like, mm-hmm. it might even feel worse. It's like wicked. So now I know, and I still can't do anything about it.
Yes, and that's when I said to you that double whammy aspect of it. Even if you get to, when you said you have to know what the cause is, even if you know the cause, it doesn't change the pattern. The pattern will be existing independently of itself because it's just how you've been and you become accustomed to doing it. And sometimes if you have a learned emotional state, and what I mean by that is if you've become so accustomed to feeling a certain way, like say if you have identified with insecurity. So all of us have insecurities. We're human beings. We can't not have them. But it's different if you own an insecurity, you're trying something new and you're not so sure of yourself, but you're able to keep going and you pass over it. That's a feeling. You can have an insecure feeling and then you can, you know, rah-rah yourself through it and it passes and you're off and it's not a problem anymore. Mm-hmm. The difference between having a feeling of insecurity or identifying with insecurity are two different things, and that would be the problem. If you start to identify with an emotion and start to think that's who you are, then that feeling will nearly become unconscious because you'll be so accustomed to feeling that way, you won't even have to even realize that you're feeling that way. It's become so normative to you. Mm-hmm. So you'll just be shoving yourself full of the food, not even knowing what the cause is. And sometimes you might not even understand the trigger. Mm-hmm. But if you're eating, you can pretty much be like, if you're drawn to that food, and trying to put a Band-Aid on the problem or nurture the problem or feel better, then yes, even when you get to that core issue, that core state, then the question is, what do you now do to overturn it, transform it, and find other healthy ways to cope? And that is tricky. That's tricky because when you associate something as your savior, as your rescuer, as your defense, it's really hard to give it up. You have to find that part that is so desperately needing saving will need a healthy way to get what is needed.
Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, so, I mean, well, that's, so the, yes. so the step is you getting to the identification stage, and then from there, it's the repetitions to lay it based on the neuroplasticity is to mm-hmm. get yourself out of, like you said, it's not a feeling anymore. It's an identity. And the idea
yes.
is you got to change that identity.
Yes.
And that's interesting you say that because some people, specifically the word identity, because some of our people who've gone through our transformation contest and have got into really good shape actually experience an identity crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the best shape of their life because they wake up and look at themselves and they're fearful that that's not really who they are. They have this imposter phenomenon kick in, and
right.
they've gone their whole so long in their life with, you know, their bodies being something that they look in the mirror and they're like, oh, I'm, you know, it's maybe it doesn't like repulse them, but it's they've always wanted their body to look better, and then
mm-hmm.
they finally have a body that they look in the mirror and they go, wow, I like the way that looks. then the very next feeling is, but that's not me, and it's somehow I'm not going to be this for very long, and I'm going to go back.
Mm-hmm.
And so tell me, so that's revealing that their identity isn't the new body, it's the old body.
That's right. And like when you ask me, like I've had people, for instance, who've come in and they say, you know, I want to, you know, change my lifestyle and lose weight and feel better and blah, 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 which of course is, you know, a fabulous intention. And they are really convinced that's what they want to do. And they're right, they want it. But another part of them is afraid of it. And the whatever that problem is something that is still serving you, even though it might make no sense logically to you. It's something that you have utilized in your life and has served you. So, for instance, I can give one example of one woman that I knew that came in, and she said that she had been doing everything, but yet she still wasn't losing weight. And when we started working together, she started losing. Because what she understood was what she went inside herself and saw her own relationship to her body, that had been, she'd been using this to protect her from her fear of intimacy. She was afraid of being hurt, so then when, by hiding behind this body, that she could keep people away, then it was serving her. So until she could learn to find her own, feel more confident, not just meaning confident in herself, but meaning feeling that she can handle difficulties, to understand that she could handle things that she was afraid of, maybe abandonment or rejection, then she could let go of her attachment to the body that was keeping the world away from her. She had to find knowledge. She had to know that she could handle rejection or abandonment, which is what she was afraid of. And this is what it was protecting her from.
Right, which was the fear of the intimacy, because that's what could potentially happen, is the rejection or abandonment if you get too close to somebody.
That's right. Or just meeting someone and not liking, you know, even beyond, before you can even get to that, just being rejected.
Oh, yeah, I mean,
like
not, yeah.
Someone not even rejecting you, just the whole, I mean, it's so many different levels. And so many people, and we're conditioned this way for sure, we measure our worth and value based on something external. So we look for something to validate us. And so, for instance, yesterday I had someone I work with, and not anything to do with weight issue, but it's good to, if you separate from a particular issue, you can look at another, it's the same principle. But she came in, her issue was that she was having anxiety attacks. And beneath the anxiety attacks was a fear of vulnerability, that she was afraid of bad things happening to her. So hence, by anticipating bad things, she could somehow protect herself from it. So this constant anticipating of a negative thing would somehow give her some control over an inevitability, that she had control over it. Of course, understanding that, you realize this is completely self-defeating. You're creating the very thing that you're trying to protect yourself from. You're feeding the problem. It's basically the same principle, that you will be using something that's unhealthy, trying to cope or anticipate what you see as an inevitability, an expectation that you would have learned. So if you expect someone to be rejected, for instance, and you have not learned or been taught or had an environment that provided you with enough self-reinforcement, positive reinforcement of your worth and value, then it becomes the between the rock and the hard place, where you want validation, but at the same time you're afraid to be rejected. So it would become a tiered system. What is the worst thing to happen? And for the average person in that situation, the rejection would be much, much worse. So you hide out. Mm-hmm.
So you isolate yourself to avoid the potential for rejection.
Right.
And then you end up rejected because you're rejecting yourself.
Right. So if a person has lost weight and achieved a goal, and then might reveal what's beneath having had that weight on, that was serving you in some way. And that may not be logical in your mind, but is logical to your emotions. So for instance, when this person yesterday was describing her anxiety in terms of that she'd have these, start thinking of what if this happened? What she thought was illogical things that made no reason, like what if I'm on the subway and a bomb goes off? What if this happens? And she was like, but that's silly thing. It makes no sense. But when she uncovered it and realized, wait a minute, I'm afraid of my vulnerability and I'm feeling unsafe. So in my mind, if I think this is giving me some sense of control, it keeps me always on my toes, then it makes sense why you would think this way. So
it's as if she's prepared for anything, so to speak.
Anything. And that's her way of having control. So when you begin to understand that, so if you, the point is that if you lose this weight and you have this new identity, there would have been some association to food or the weight or as having something that served you, that you had an association to it. And when that's removed, then you're exposed. You're stripped. You don't have this illusion of protection anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So now you do have to face the world. You have to go out. A person who has, in a society that we're so cosmetically inclined and so a person loses weight and they've had a fear of exposure. And many of us have fears of exposure. Many of us have fears of rejection and being judged. Even though if you have on weight, you're feeling, well, I'm always judged that way. But if you've always had on weight or that's been an issue for you, then you're accustomed, quote-unquote, to that judgment. Suddenly now you're exposed. And
well, people get comfortable with it. It's part of
yes.
It becomes their dominant program, so to speak.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, we even talk about that. We call it having the spotlight on you, and our we've so now I'm gonna expo- I don't think I've ever told you this, but we've had people who go from being at a body size or weight that gets them negative attention.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe they get picked on or it's
right.
Sort of people. They don't. The attention is. We just call it negative. Either they're not getting
right.
Attention from people they want, or they're getting the wrong attention. Then they
mm-hmm.
lose weight to the point where their body's just kind of normal, and they blend into the crowd. And now all of a sudden,
mm-hmm.
there's no spotlight. It's not a negative
right.
spotlight anymore. It's gone. But then our systems are designed to get you to what we've determined is, if you want it, what we've determined aesthetically as. You kind of like now you're in shape. Now you can be on the cover of a fitness magazine type body, but now all of a sudden the spotlight's back on you again, and that's a pattern we've noticed. And it's almost like being safely anonymous in the crowd of average is
right.
safer and easier than being on either side. But and I don't think anyone anticipated that getting into cover model shape would be almost as stressful as being really out of shape. But I think now talking to you, it's becoming obvious that. It's because it reveals something about yourself and about why it was safe to be the other way, and now
Absolutely.
It's gone.
Absolutely, and change. We're creatures of habit. That is our systems are designed that way for survival. Meaning that if you know the world, if you know the world that you're in, and you can anticipate it, which is why anxiety can be so so many people experience anxiety, for instance. If you know the world, then you can anticipate it. So when you change, you suddenly will feel like you're flung out into a new world. Well, how do you anticipate this new world? How do you cope with this new world? And if you're still applying the same old coping styles to your new world, then you would find a conflict for sure.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, yeah. I mean, I just did that. I went through a bunch of big-time changes, moving and all kinds of things change, and it rattles you. He's just not ready for
absolutely.
Like you said, the old pattern doesn't work anymore. You got to come up with a new one.
And we learn like coping styles very early, and that we keep applying. That's the one thing that I've certainly learned in my work is that whatever coping style we learn early in life, we keep using that same old, tired, unproductive coping style because we associate that coping style with safety. And taking care of us. And usually it's just maladaptive. It's not helping us. It's not helping us in our adult world. But we'll still keep applying it. We'll still be thinking in the same way and still using that same old coping style. I think coping styles, like relationships, should be evaluated regularly.
Mm-hmm.
We should be evaluating our coping styles. We should be looking at how we are coping with the world, how we think we need to cope. But oddly enough, we don't do that. And not only do we not do that, but we usually defend the problem. because we're so attached to how we cope. So if a person is always struggling with an issue, they'll continue the same way of struggling because they consider that the way to manage the problem. Even when they can see and it's not working and things are falling apart, you will keep fighting for the problem.
Yeah, and it,
yes.
It seems illogical, but after going through some of the self-imaging therapy, you get to the point where you get to see that. And I like what you said. I never thought about it until you just said it, but it's the only way you can ever see yourself as others see you.
Yes.
And that's pretty revealing because everybody can think of their group of friends or their family, and they can pick out. You're the last person to understand yourself. Everyone else gets you first.
And I think that's what
your stuff does. I guess that's the startling part about yourself. Like, oh, I didn't realize that's what is really going on, is when you get to sort of see yourself objectively or as objectively as possible.
Yes. And to understand, I mean, part of that objectivity is, again, seeing these associations to what you think is protecting you or keeping you safe and understanding that how you can change those things. I mean, the key is that we're not just going in as a voyeur, looking at yourself, so to speak, and you're observing, oh, here I am doing this. Now it's about how do we change this? How do we make these, transform this? Something that you now get is not productive, which you would have gone into the session associating as something as working for you. Oddly enough, the problem that anyone comes in as a problem, and the thing you say you want to change, once you get inside yourself, you will realize how you associate that as something that's serving you. And I see that without fail, and that's always a shock, that the thing that you think is serving you is actually self-defeating. And then, because if you don't get that, you'll keep repeating the pattern. And I think in terms of emotional eating and food, everyone that comes to me says, oh, I want to change this thing. But once they go deeper inside themselves, the very thing they want to change, they'll understand, is the very thing that they're attached to and actually defending the problem inside themselves. And that's where, and that's the kind of tug of war that can go on inside our minds without us understanding that there's one part that wants to change it and one part that wants to hold on to it. And we tend to think in our brains about the part that we want to change. Oh, I don't want this. I don't like this. I want to change it. We don't focus on our attachment to the problem. And if I can say one thing that would help in emotional eating, start to think of how you're attached, what you associate this food to being. Look at your attachment to the problem versus thinking, I want to lose weight. You need to ask instead, what are the ways in which I don't want to lose weight? How does this weight serve me? How does this food serve me? And then start debunking some of those myths and realizing that. And if you start to realize your attachment and deal with the attachments, you are at a better entry level in thinking you want change.
Do you get a lot of pushback, or like do you have some
to the, when you say pushback, are you referring to?
Yeah, do you have some people who get there and they're like, you know, get to some of it, and then just it's too much, and they don't want to be there, like.
Yes, I certainly had. Well, because the work again is self-revealing. If you don't really want to make the change, first of all, they will absolutely stop. Sometimes I do get pushback in the sessions themselves, where a person is really resisting making that change. That's my job to help them to learn to move through those resistances and get to that better place as they begin to understand how they're being self-defeating. And how this attaching or holding on or defending the problem isn't serving them. So I can spend some time for sure coming to that awakening. This is not serving you. I'm really seeing that. And if a person really wants to make a transformation, then they will make that shift. If they don't want the transformation, which, you know, there's no judgment in that. I think we have to honor where we're at or who we are. If that's how you feel, honor it by all means. I guess what I would say to anyone is find your way to wherever you are at, and if you don't want to make those changes, come to peace with it. Find your peace. So, yeah, if there's a pushback where they don't want it, I would be like, that's fine, but make your peace with it. Make your peace. This is where you're at, and you don't want to change it. Stop fighting within yourself.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You know, there are people, like in relationships, for instance, that complain. They're never going to do anything about it. Make peace with it, rather than be miserable all the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just accept the fact that what you're in is what you're in, and if that's as good enough, then...
Yes, that's good enough. Try and find the peace with yourself, yes.
Right, yeah. But, and I like what you said there about the resistance manifests itself in the image, within the image.
Absolutely.
So, like, along the way, it's... And because I know I've talked to some people, I kind of laughed about it. I had sent somebody to you just recently who was telling me about their when they were in their image, and right at the crux of the moment where she had to embrace herself, because her issue was learning to take care of herself, and right at the moment when she needed to take care of herself, she just said, "I don't know what to do," which was ironically funny because she needed you to tell her to hug. Give yourself a hug.
Right.
And she's like, I didn't know I could do that.
And oftentimes you're actually even doing it in the moment, but not defining it or even feeling the experience, which is part of it, that you actually, transformation only comes, you have to really be able to feel that other state. For instance, when you talk about they lose the weight, they look in the mirror, they shift their identity. One way to help yourself if you're in that state is that then you start to focus on what do I feel like in this new identity? What does this give me? And start to really connect with those positive emotions. Mm-hmm. Like I feel, happier, or I feel better about myself. Really make a connection to what that positive is and make so that your mind is shifting to that positive association to the new thing so that you can now, because otherwise you can get really lost in that negative association.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I try to tell people that getting from one shape to the new shape, that's just the first step, and then maintaining it is the longer tailed step. But I guess it's starting to become obvious that maintenance isn't just finding out how many calories to eat or where to scale your workouts back to or fitting in social events without really gaining the weight back. It's actually learning to be in that new identity and discard
Absolutely.
The old identity. That's actually, I think what we're coming to is that's the real key to maintenance is accepting that new identity. And that's a deeper issue than just figuring out how many calories to eat.
Oh, absolutely. And I mean, what I see, you know,
because everyone can gut out. I don't mean to cut you off. Everyone can grind, can willpower their way through a 2 or 3 or 4 month weight loss. Just about everybody can. It's tough, but lots of people can grind that out. It's accepting the new you, which seems to be the harder part.
Well, where I would go with this is what I see, and I'm sure if I was to do the work with all of the people that you just described, it would come back to one very strong pattern, a deep-seated self-loathing. And what I mean by that, and I know I can imagine some people cringing, but there's a part where they will be very self-critical. And so if you're soldiering through your 3 to 4 months, for instance, of your plan, and you're doing it in a really hard way, you know, driving yourself, and at the end of the plan and you're done, you're still in a self-critical mode. You're still not seeing yourself in a positive light, like looking at yourself. You're still beating up yourself. And if you went through the whole program beating yourself up to get there, and you have that pattern of self-beating, when you're in that mirror looking, you're still going to be looking at your eyes, even though you've achieved the goal, through the eyes of self-beating, meaning you're putting yourself down. You're not looking at yourself in a positive light. And that tendency to put ourselves down and many people will, if I've looked at that pattern with them, they'll be like, I don't want to give this up because that's how I achieve something. Yet, they've come to me with the problem that they're not getting anywhere. They're stuck. But they want to give up the pattern because they think it's their motivational force. It's not working. So it's very likely that when they're looking at the mirror, they're looking at themselves with critical eyes, which they might have gone through the entire program with. So they're still back. You take yourself anywhere you go. So whether you're in a body with 20 pounds extra, 20 pounds lighter, if you're self-critical, that self-critic has not changed. You're going to still look at yourself from the same eyes. So it's really about when you achieve that goal now it gets to the next point. Who are you and how do you want to be and how do you want to treat yourself? And it would come back to renegotiating your kind of inner dialogue and your way of viewing yourself, the lens through which you see or understand yourself. And if you're very much attached to your self-meter, which many, many people are, and I see it as a chronic problem, then that's probably what's directing the show and directing the eyes to what you're seeing yourself and the process. And if you're there, you've achieved the goal, but you can't enjoy your success because you're still beating up on yourself.
Yeah, and that's there's a couple things you brought up there. This, like, if people identifying with their just beating up on themselves or their self-beater, as you said, and that just seems to be chronic.
Yes.
I mean, and I want to ask you where you think that, why that's so prevalent. But on top of that, I think we've seen that with a lot of our people who've gotten great shape. They literally need myself or Brad or any. They need somebody else to tell them, no, you're. You look like you got there. You're there. You don't need to like it. People just aren't sure. I mean, they're in what I consider the best. Like, I'm super proud of them. I think they're in amazing shape. I'd put them on the cover of our books. Actually, we're going to do that. We do a cover model. We're going to start a cover model version, little categories where when people get in really good shape, we're going to feature them on our programs. So it's still to the point where everyone else sees the change and they're still not satisfied. And I think it's, like you said, it really makes a lot of sense when, as you say, they've been beating themselves up before and now they're literally fit to be on the cover of a magazine and they still can't see it and they still beat themselves up.
Mm-hmm.
And so that has to change. Like, that has to, other, I mean, that's really, they have to accept the fact, yeah, you're there, and it's, you have to believe that you're there now. And I guess that's where the deeper work actually has to happen to not go back to the old pattern that seemed to, like you said, serve them, even though it got them into a body that they didn't want. And then the cycle goes over. So where do you think I don't even know if you've developed a theory or if you even know this, why is so many people beat themselves up?
Oh, I mean, several answers. One, I'm going to say that we are as a species, we're self-reflective. That's what actually separates us. The degree to which we can self-reflect, that's what separates us from other animal species. We can step back and observe ourselves, which, of course, we go even deeper than that in the self-imaging therapy. And so when we have a self-reflective mind where we observe our behaviors, and it's important for us, if we don't have that, for instance, we don't have a conscience where we can actually say, you know, right, wrong, good, bad, no murder is not acceptable, you know what I mean, going out and hurting other people, that kind of thing. So we have a self-monitoring, self-regulating, self-observing aspect of our humanity, which is what makes us so fabulous. At the same time, the very thing that is our evolutionary advantage is also our disadvantage. When we are doing our self-reflectivity, how do we go about doing it? And if we have learned critical voices, a lot of it comes from early childhood, having heard critical reinforcement, where, you know, you're told, for instance, that was bad, this is bad. And if there has been enough negative reinforcement, then you can have an extraordinary self-beating mechanism and voice within you. And so those who have been exposed to more criticism in their early life or in their family would particularly have a well-oiled, well-honed critical voice within them. That's one. Again, just because we're human and we're moving through life self-observing, we can then internalize some negative experiences that we go through because that's what life is about, and then start to think of ourselves as the problem. If we had learned that even earlier in life where we start to think we're the problem, we cause this bad thing to happen, we're self-blaming, then from the self-blame, and many people do that. If there's a problem in their childhood, they will think, I'm the problem, I caused this bad thing to happen. Then they start seeing their life in terms of, I'm the problem, and the self-blaming then will lead to self-criticism. We meet criticism everywhere in the world, in our life, at school. We do experience rejection. Not everyone can like us. If we internalize any of those experiences, if we start to believe, if you have, say, a romance gone wrong, and he or she rejected you, and you start to, then you go, you know, what did I do wrong? Then you start beating up on yourself. You start, and last of all, because we are an imperfect species, unquestioned, We have positives and we have negatives. And we do have to balance these two aspects of ourselves where we have all kind of impulses. We have impulses for anger. We have impulses to hate. We have critical impulses of other people, judgment, all kind of things. So we have two parts of ourselves. And if that part that is critical starts, we start to overuse that in terms of our own self-reflectivity based on some painful experiences or hard experiences, then that part, if we start to overjudge our own behaviors, and so even in the best of environments, we can still come out with a self-judging because we either want to live up to extreme standards of ourselves that are unrealistic, and we do have to come to terms with our imperfections and learn how to manage our human foibles in a self-nurturing way that's self-directive, meaning I can embrace myself, the fact that I've done this thing that I might label as a mistake or that I want to change, but I embrace myself understanding that I didn't know any better now, or now understanding this let me recognize how other ways I can function, but we're doing that as a nurture, in a nurturing way rather than a self-critical way.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah,
those are the many different ways.
Right, and so, but it's pretty consistent. I mean, people do it all the time. I mean,
yes.
It happens, and I notice in both of our forms, in the men and the women, people just, they can't, they just seem, I don't know if it's just their words, but they just seem to not be able to recognize how far they've come or what they've done. And so after talking to you about the fact they're identifying with their previous self, that makes perfect sense why they can't recognize it. One of our guys even said, this is really interesting, he said that he can't tell by looking in the mirror
mm-hmm.
what he's done. He actually has to take a picture, and then he looks at the picture, and then he actually can see where he's at. And it just, and now what you say, now it makes obvious sense why that's happening. But him and I couldn't really figure it out. And he was just like, I don't know, it just seems to be one more step removed from yourself. And then he can actually appreciate the picture of himself much more than he can the live image in the mirror.
He can't feel that. And I would guess that he's very self-critical. So,
yeah, I mean, he did great, but and I guess he was using that criticism to get himself as far as he can, but
right,
now he's got to learn
right.
to accept that he's in really good shape now.
And then once you achieve this goal, then it does take you to deeper issues, and that's the thing. Like often when we are looking for something, let's say losing weight, which is or eating healthy and changing a lifestyle, which is a really positive thing to do for ourselves, we have to ask, like, where is that coming from? If we're doing that because we want validation or we're looking to feel better about ourselves, if we don't internally feel good within or haven't developed that inside, then this external change or even, and I'm not diminishing at all how important it is to eat well and exercise, because that's not just an internal change, that's a holistic health change. And it's very important to mind, body, health, and well-being. But if you have an unhealthy approach to your life, emotionally and mentally, then that other part will then really start showing up and bubbling up. And you have to look at that, because now it's, I've done this, but I still don't feel better. I'm still not.
And now you have an inherent conflict, because now your body doesn't match how you're viewing yourself on the inside.
Yes,
exactly. You have what appears to seem like a healthy-looking body and a body that gets positive attention on the outside, but on the inside you're giving yourself, you have negative self-talk, negative emotions about it, so now you're in an inherent conflict.
Right, like, exactly. Like, I remember there was this one woman that I'd work with, and she came to me after she had lost the weight. And prior to losing the weight, she didn't get that much. She got more attention from guys after she lost weight. But the thing is, the type of guys that she was attracted to prior to losing the weight and after were the same. So hence, she was still dating the same guys who would treat her very poorly because she had insecurities and lack of worth from within. Mm-hmm. So the only difference was she had more jerky guys. That's all. There were more jerks around rather than less.
Yeah.
So it can overwhelm you because you're actually now having more problems, but on a different level.
Right, right. So
you know,
so I guess
but you're still being abandoned, right?
Right, yeah, just by just more opportunities. Yeah.
Yes, oh, more opportunities to be abandoned.
Yeah, she made it worse. So there's an example where having not bothering taking care of her body would have served her better. It would have given her less opportunities to be abandoned or rejected.
Continually, yes, but then she'd be sitting around feeling her loneliness and blaming her body for the problem. If she only lost weight, then she wouldn't have, you know, she could attack her body. Mm. When her body changed, then who should, you know.
That's not an excuse anymore.
It's not an excuse, but again, if you don't see your body as looking good, you can still use your body as an excuse in your beating post.
Oh, yeah, because
many
then she can be like, well, I need to lose even more weight.
Yes, it never ends. Or you start, you know, homing in on this. Oh, this is not, this little part is hanging over here. Yeah. Like you start using your, because if you've always used your body as your beating post, even if you have an ideal weight or you're looking really great, you can still use your body as a beating post. And anyone who keeps in shape, I exercise, I eat well, you can do that. You can, doesn't, there's no end to which you can, quote unquote, perfect your body. So you do have to just draw a line and say, good enough kind of thing, and I'm taking care of me good enough, versus starting to home in on, oh, this little part here, this little part there. Just enjoy your success, and that as long as you're really focusing on just holistic well-being, I am eating well, I am exercising, then you start, you don't have to worry about, oh, this little part over there. You start really enjoying that benefit. It does encourage you then to maintain it. If you're not getting a reward from your new system, if you're not enjoying it, you're not seeing your change, you're not feeling the betterment, it doesn't give you a whole lot of motivation. Because if you're motivated to exercise and eat well, and the goal of your intention is the end of this, all this effort, you're going to get this reward of feeling better and et cetera, and you're not getting that reward, then you're not going
to
be motivated.
Just stay
going.
There, yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah,
that,
for sure.
That's where your motivation can really dampen, which is why I think people then put the weight back on because of the reason that they did it with the expectation at the end of the road, they're going to have this perfect little life. Mm-hmm. Everything's going to be solved now. If I only lost weight, everything would be solved. Like in that woman's idea, I wouldn't be lonely if I lost the weight and I could get myself a guy. But nothing changed because she didn't change from inside.
Yep. Well, and I guess I guess we're getting to the end here, but the overriding point is the holistic. It's got to be all three things: mind, emotions, and body. It can't
absolutely.
Now, any one of them sort of can lead.
Yes.
It sort of doesn't matter which one you choose first. It's going to reveal the others anyways. Like we said,
I agree.
Are people getting shape, and then all of a sudden they're like, wait a minute, I feel like an imposter. So it's going to reveal it to you one way or the other, so you can choose which one starts it, but you kind of, to complete the puzzle, you have to work on all three.
I agree, and I think the great thing about, you know, the process of getting into shape and eating well, it begins a process of learning how to take care of yourself. Then you need to take it to the next level. Because when you wake up and you feed yourself, you know, healthy food, and you don't stuff yourself with junk food, you are in a process of treating yourself well, taking care of yourself, and treating yourself like you deserve something good versus abusing yourself. So if you start to really, you know, in that process, you're thinking, oh, okay, I am taking care of me. And that's what you need to be thinking when you're going through a process of transformation in terms of health, diet, and exercise. If you're understanding this itself, this exercise, this healthy item is, and you're viewing it through the lens that I'm taking care of me, you're actually changing that critic. So it's really important to understand, not just as a goal or intention that I'm losing weight, so at the end of the day, everybody will love me. But in fact, every time you feed yourself well or exercise, you are loving you. You are taking care of you. And if you can view it through that lens, then it helps not to need this outside world to validate you. Then it really does come from something internal in terms of, I am worth feeding myself well. I am worth exercising.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And then from there, if the issue, and you know, for some people that might be it, but if the issues run deeper, then they got to do some of that other work, which
absolutely is, yes, but that's just a, you know, I think if you can really try and make that connection,
it's an opportunity to make that connection and start reading.
It's an opportunity to make that connection.
Yeah.
But the thing is, if you're saying it to yourself but not feeling it, it won't work. Meaning you can say, oh, I'm feeding myself good, I'm taking care of me, but you don't feel that you're taking care of you, you don't identify with that worth, then you really have to dig deeper.
Which comes back to your stuff.
Well, yes, finding a way to really take care of yourself an understanding that that's what you deserve and that's what you're worth. Is
yep.
At the end of the day, what we all need as human beings, and no one doesn't need that. All of us need to feed ourselves healthy lifestyle in every way, from thoughts, emotions, food, diet, and they all feed into. When you know what you're worth, you feed yourself well.
Mm-hmm.
You take care of your body. They all feed into a beautiful, wonderful routine and lifestyle.
Okay, I think I don't think we could talk for another 2 hours.
But I think
we're almost at an hour and 10 minutes. We're good. I think we're good there. So that was really good. I wouldn't mind doing another one of these at some point if you'd want to.
Oh, no, I'd love to, for sure. And especially if people send in questions. And maybe we could do one where they have questions and we can answer some of the questions. So we could invite that as well.
Sure. Okay.
So their own personal journeys and own personal struggles and how we can answer some of those things, as well as cover some more questions. I mean, other things that come up.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody is interested in actually pursuing any sort of therapy with Nicola, I highly recommend it. She helps me a lot, and I think your stuff's better than everybody else's. So that's just that's blatant and it's biased. But anyways, if anyone likes what you've heard and wants to pursue it, we're gonna be linking to some of Nicola's stuff, so you can maybe set up some sessions with her. And you don't have to come see her; it can all be done via phone or Skype. So that's something. You can either email me; there'll be contact information. There'll be other information. So thanks for being on the call.
Thank you for having me, John. I appreciate it.
So for Nicola Bird, I'm John Barbin, and that's your AI and VI podcast.